In South Carolina in 1850, I mean, the book basically starts in 1850 and ends in 1860. It's the 10 years leading up to the Civil War. In South Carolina, formerly it had been possible to free slaves. Formerly it had been possible to even leave some inheritance to people of color. But the younger generation of whites fought for the most oppressive laws to prohibit all emancipation and all inheritance. Because unlike our sort of myth of it was just Mr. Jefferson and Sally Hemings, there were so many white planters having mixed race families that their white offspring felt threatened. Their sort of droit de seigneur, birthright, was being challenged by these usurpers who they didn't even want to acknowledge as sharing their own blood. And so that sets the backdrop for this, because the laws got more and more repressive. And that, for me, was a revelation, because, you know, I grew up in the 60s with the civil rights movement, and I think of the younger generation as being progressive.
Right, yeah.
But this was completely opposite.
So that's the backdrop, Rob, for this particular court case of this man, Elijah Willis, and his efforts to travel to various northern cities in non-slave states to try to figure out some way to emancipate his family, which were also his slaves.
Right. Well, initially it wasn't to non-slave states. He didn't start off as an abolitionist. He didn't have a sort of a political agenda. He wasn't trying to make a statement that way. He fell in love late in life, had never married, and had
four children
with this woman who had already had three by a slave when she was on a former plantation.
So we have this older bachelor plantation owner, cotton plantation.
Right.
And he's, yes, so now he has a wife, he has several children with this wife, who is his slave, and then also her mother is part of the sort of inner circle of their
family
as well.
Exactly. He's got his mother-in-law, his wife, and seven children living in the big house.
Mm-hmm.
His brother-in-law and his wife and children are living in the slave quarters. I mean,
right.
It's a complicated situation.
Yeah.
And, you know, he sort of comes into this emancipation thing gradually. He comes into it out of love for Amy and the children, but then it sort of grows. And Amy sort of feels like, well, you know, if you're going to free us, you have to free everybody. And that's a very hard thing for him to come to terms with, because the reason he never married was partly because he was so dedicated to building his lumber and his cotton business that he didn't want to lose his profits. And so to kind of give that up, or find a way to transfer it that was viable, was both an emotional challenge and a legal challenge.
So as a result of this awkward situation he put himself in this cultural stranglehold of the mores of the white society around him in South Carolina, Elijah and his family had to really maintain this veil of secrecy as they go about making these clandestine trips to kind of inquire about the laws of manumission in these other states. Their first endeavor to head out and see what the broader horizons had to offer was a trip to Baltimore. Talk about this trip that Elijah takes to Baltimore with Amy, his wife, and their family. What's at stake and what they learn there?
Well, I wasn't able to get a whole lot of sort of documentary evidence about this. I know that he went. He took all of them up here, and it didn't work, and he took them all of them back. So I had to kind of come up with a plausible scenario for that. And I thought, well, okay, this man is a businessman. You know, he produces cotton, he produces lumber. Baltimore is not only a port city, but it was the hub of the B&O Railroad. And I thought, well, it's totally plausible that he would come up here for business reasons, to ship his products and establish new opportunities there. I also realized that he needed to have some kind of banking contact, and I looked up to see what banking houses were operating in 1850. And of course, Alex Brown was already established here. Alexander Brown's son, George, was running the office here in Baltimore. So I made George Brown his contact. I realized he would also need a lawyer. And I didn't want to make up a lawyer. I wanted to find out if I could find a lawyer here in Baltimore. And I stumbled across this amazing document on the internet called Matchett's Baltimore Director. And it's like a white pages and yellow pages of Baltimore in 1850. It's got the names, addresses, and professions of everybody.
Hmm.
with pictures.
Everything except phone numbers, obviously.
Everything except phone numbers, exactly. You know, and I just, it blew me away. And I thought, well, okay, I can look up a lawyer here, but I also need a hotel mm-hmm. where they can stay. And the Admiral Fells Inn was in operation back then. And back then it was more like a sailor's tavern boarding house than a fancy hotel. So I thought, well, that's plausible because they could arrive by boat and there they are. So the lawyer needs to be someplace close. And I look up in Baltimore's Matchett directory and I find this William Dorsey, attorney, 3 Fayette Street. I said, oh, that's perfect. That's close enough.
Stone's throw from the Admiral Fell.
Stone's throw from the Admiral Fell. That's perfect.
Yeah.
Then I looked up William Dorsey to find out, you know, what kind of lawyer this guy was. And it turns out he was a supporter of Henry Clay's. And I thought, oh, my God, that's just too serendipitous to be possible. And I also realized that Dorsey is a family name of mine on my mother's side of the family. My mother's family had come at one point from Maryland. So I thought, oh, this is just surreal. So I invented these characters in the context of Elijah, but I did it in a way that I hope is consistent with the facts of the story and plausible enough to come close to the truth of what actually happened.
Since we've got a Baltimore listening audience, it might be worth reading this passage from when Elijah and his family arrive by passenger ship. They're floating through the Baltimore Harbor into the city, and you paint this very evocative portrait of the city as it might have been in the mid-19th century. So I wonder if you might read the passage when this rural southern family lays eyes on Baltimore for the first time.
Sure, I'd be glad to. As the North Carolina headed up the harbor, they passed ships from all around the world. Whalers from New England, clippers in the China trade, sturdy merchantmen from England and France and Spain, packets that plied the inland waterways, privateers that sailed the Caribbean, navy frigates and men-of-war, and countless others. The harbor seemed a floating forest of masts and yardarms and rigging. Sailors shouted to each other across cargo-laden decks in a dozen languages. Closer by, past Canton and Lighthouse Point, they spotted Fells Point, their destination. There appeared to be a large plaza by the wharf, with a wide boulevard leading up from there inland and uphill towards the interior of the city, church spires punctuating the horizon in all directions. There was a great deal of activity in the streets. Carriages, wagons, street vendors, shopkeepers, sailors, merchants, all manner of folk going to and fro. Once the North Carolina had docked, Elijah gathered the family. "Well, children, here we are," he announced. "We'd best be gathering our things and get ready to go ashore. Elder, I need you and Alec and Philip to handle the luggage. Mama Celia, keep a tight hold on the girls. Girls, don't let go of your grandma. Amy, watch your step going down the gangplank, darling. We don't want that baby getting baptized prematurely." The family, filled with a mixture of excitement and trepidation, made their way amidships to debark, along with the other passengers, onto the busy wharf and the bustle of Thames Street. Elijah was about to hail a carriage when he saw diagonally across Thames Street from the wharf on the corner of the plaza a sign indicating the Admiral Fell Inn, their designated address. "Well," he exclaimed, "that certainly is convenient. I never imagined our hotel would be so close to the landing." He called a couple of porters and indicated they should bring the luggage across the street to the inn while he hustled the family together and led them to their lodgings. Amy clung to his arm nervously. Mama Celia was looking every which way, like she was expecting disaster to strike at any moment, clutching the girl's hands so tightly they winced and whined, "Mama Celia, you're hurting me." The boys simply gawked in wonder and excitement at everything. Hoping for a gracious accommodations, Elijah was distressed to discover that the Admiral Fell was more a sailor's boarding house and tavern than what he considered a real hotel. They made their way across the plaza through longshoremen, carriers, drunken sailors, and ladies with heavily rouged cheeks and tightly laced bodices displaying the buxom welcome sailors dream of on a long voyage. The boys gaped in fascination, while Mama Celia shielded the girls' eyes from these dockside denizens.
Rob Stuckey, reading from his historical novel, A Complicated Legacy. It's based on the true story of Elijah and Amy Willis, husband and wife, master and slave, and their efforts to secure freedom and some inheritance for her and their children. And Rob, as you mentioned before, this visit to Baltimore yields kind of a disheartening result for the Willis family. Talk about the state's laws at the time and what they learned regarding manumission.
Yeah, it was painful, and it was a revelation for me, too, to kind of dig into this to see the extent to which the system was really draconian. It was possible to emancipate slaves in Maryland, of course, being a border state. But once the slave was emancipated, the slave was obligated to leave the state. So obviously that wasn't an option. It was also set up so that you could only emancipate slaves between the ages of 10 and 45, which meant that his younger children and his mother-in-law couldn't have been emancipated. Then, even if freed, there were definite strictures on what kinds of trades and what kinds of property slaves could own. They were not allowed to go to public schools. There were a few schools available for free blacks, but it was clearly not a very hospitable situation. And even once emancipated, if they got into any trouble with the law, they could be put back into slavery. They could be sold off. If they couldn't leave the state without permission from the authorities, they couldn't be outside of the state for more than 30 days and return. It was a system set up to discourage freedom, even though Baltimore had an unusually high percentage of free blacks living here.
The story, of course, goes on from there. They make other efforts. Cincinnati plays a major role later in the story, not to give too much away. I guess it's a historical novel, so you kind of know the ending of the story. But let me switch gears, Rob, and ask you sort of an elephant in the room question that kind of lingers over this whole conversation. And that is, I can imagine listeners hearing this conversation and wondering what warrant you might possibly have to write a story like this. And by saying that, I mean, you're a white man, in fact, the descendant of Henry Clay, who, as you mentioned, was a slaveholder, albeit a reluctant one. I'm sure you've meditated on this precarious position you've taken on. I mean, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, it's an issue I've been dealing with all my life because I've been involved in the civil rights movement, and I was a clergyman for many years and had a very interracial parish. So it's not a new issue for me. In fact, when we had a book signing at Barnes & Noble's back in July, one of the people who came asked me, you know, did you feel you had a right to write this story? And was that a problem for you? And I said, well, actually, the way the question was put, did you have a right to write a story about black people? And it was an African-American who asked the question. And I said, well, you know, I never thought of it as writing a story about black people. I mean, I think of it as a story about people, and I'm a person, so I could relate. I just saw this as an intensely human story. I mean, you've got this awful conflict. You know, this man falls in love with the woman, unlike some slave owners who simply used their slaves sexually at their pleasure. He clearly loved this woman and loved their children. This wasn't just an abusive situation. But he himself is, in a sense, enslaved by his own system as much as the slaves on the plantation are enslaved by him. And that's what I thought was so interesting about the story, was how do you reconcile the irreconcilable? What do you have to go through emotionally to deal with this? Amy, from all the evidence, does not appear to have been simply an opportunist looking for her own freedom. She cared about Elijah. Elijah cared about her in an environment where that was outrageous, scandalous. And yet they found a way to keep the family together. And I think it says a lot about Elijah that he decided he wanted to not only free Amy and his mother-in-law and their children, but the rest of the slaves, and not leave anything to his white relations. And he came by that gradually, too, because he wrote an earlier will that left it, before he fell in love with her, left everything to his white relations, as would have been the custom. So he had to have undergone a huge emotional change. And I could relate to that because I grew up in the 60s and I had to go through my own emotional change in dealing with the civil rights issues. And what made it possible for me was when the other was given a name and a face. When I started to meet people who were not like me and interact with them. At least who didn't appear to be like me. Discovered that they were a lot more like me than I thought, you know. And so that's kind of what was driving the story. I wanted to tell the story in a way that made it so human that you almost forgot who was black and who was white and just were dealing with the emotional realities of it.
As I read through this story, I just thought, these are people with good hearts, people who are in love with each other, but people who are just on a sociopolitical chessboard where their moves get more and more limited. And it's fascinating to see it brought to life in novel form. As we get ready to wrap up, Rob, I wonder if you might just talk a little bit more about your life outside of this book. I mean, you're sort of a fascinating character who lives, has lived a life of cross-cultural understanding in many ways.
Well, yeah, I don't fit conveniently into any category that I can think of. Yeah. I have led a very, very interesting life. Got an Ivy League education when I was 15. I got a scholarship to study in Spain for a year. I've been fluent in Spanish all my life. My wife is Spanish. I speak Spanish at home as well as at work. I'm an interpreter at Johns Hopkins Hospital. I was a clergyman for 16 years. I lived with a Hindu guru for 8.5 years and was his interpreter. My first career was actually as a sculptor. I have a degree in art from Yale and as well as a Master of Divinity degree from Yale. And I've enjoyed my life immensely. I'm still enjoying it immensely. Still have a lot of projects and things that I want to do. But the connecting link in all of that has been a fascination with people and the fundamental goodness of people. And that politically and philosophically and theologically for me, what unites us is far more important than what separates us. And it's underplayed these days. I think there's much more that unites us than separates us. And I've become sort of hypersensitive, I guess, to our own emotional dishonesty culturally sometimes, where we claim the reason for something is one thing when in fact it has much deeper roots. I mean, in South Carolina in the 1850s, this kind of white supremacist thing was a driving force. South Carolina was the first state to secede from the Union. And yet, it was never talked about as a racial issue at the time. It was talked about as states' rights. That states' rights always trump the federal rights, that states have the right to sort of cherry-pick the federal laws they want to obey and disregard the rest, which was the position of John C. Calhoun. And the winning position by Clay and Webster was, no, they don't. I mean, if you're going to be part of the Union, it's all or nothing. You can't just kind of pick and choose the parts you like. For good or for ill, we're in this thing together. And it took the Civil War to make that politically definitive, but we're still fighting that fight. And we call it one thing, but under the states' rights, there are all these racial and cultural issues that we haven't resolved yet. We're still dealing with this stuff 160 years later.
And this novel, I have to say, really shines a light on the real sort of human story underneath the sort of coded court cases and complicated legislation of the time. It's an impressive work, sir. 750 pages, this novel.
Never intended it to be that long.
Well, you're a man with an eclectic resume, and now you can add novelist to it as well. Rob Stuckey is the author of A Complicated Legacy. And Rob, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.